Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. As we dive into the general election, fundraising and political action committees are playing a central role in presidential politics. 2016 is projected to be the most expensive in U.S. history, $7 billion. According to OpenSecrets.org, as of June 17th, Hillary Clinton raised close to $400 million. She's expected to raise and spend a total of $1 billion. Donald Trump has raised close to $100 million. According to the Wall Street Journal, Republican mega donors who do not support Donald Trump are spending their money to help candidates running for Senate. The Koch brothers are expected to spend a whopping $900 million. So on today's Your Call, as the Democrats kick off their convention in Philadelphia, we continue our convention coverage by looking at the Republican and Democratic parties' corporate backers, lobbyists, and political action committees. Who is financing the presidential election? Who are the Democrats' corporate friends? How do they compare with the corporations that back the Republicans? Today, we're joined by Thomas Frank, a journalist and author of the best-selling book, What's the Matter with Kansas? His latest book is called Listen, Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. Thomas was at last week's Republican convention in Cleveland, and today he joins us from the Democratic convention in Philadelphia. Hi, Thomas. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rose. How you doing?
Good. Thanks for joining us. We're also joined by Dave Leventhal, senior political reporter with the Center for Public Integrity, a nonprofit investigative news organization that probably does a better job than almost every outlet when it comes to following the money. Dave and his colleagues were on the ground in Cleveland writing about the parties, the money, who was paying for things. And Dave is now at the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia. Hi, Dave. Welcome to the show.
Hey, a pleasure to be with you.
It's great to have you, both of you. So I want to start off by talking about this leak. On Friday, WikiLeaks released 20,000 internal emails from the Democratic Committee. WikiLeaks has not revealed the source of the leak. The Clinton campaign is accusing Russian state actors of breaking into the DNC and stealing the emails. So first, let's talk about the emails that reveal how the DNC, members of the DNC, tried to undercut and sabotage Bernie Sanders' campaign. Dave Leventhal, what are you hearing on the ground in Philadelphia? Because some of the emails that are getting the most attention are the ones about DNC staffers saying, I think I read that Sanders is an atheist. This could make several points difference with my peeps. My Southern Baptist peeps would draw a big difference between a Jew and an atheist. That's the one that's getting a lot of attention. What are you hearing in Philadelphia?
The backdrop here, Rose, is that during the primary process, when it's Democrat versus Democrat, what has always been sort of the rule of the road is that the National Party Committee will remain neutral, that they're not going to, in this case in 2016, advocate for Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders or vice versa, or for any year. They're not going to do that. Same true on the Republican side, but it does appear from these emails that they're you know, at least to some extent, there was a little bit of a fix in, and that the Democrats, the Democratic National Committee, were cheering indeed for Hillary Clinton a bit more than they were for Bernie Sanders, or at the very least, they were favoring Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders. To what material degree, that's unclear from these emails. To what extent it had an effect on the overall outcome, that's dubious. But the fact of the matter is that this is something that was profound enough where Debbie Wasserman Schultz has resigned as chairperson of the Democratic National Committee on the eve of the Democratic National Convention. If this wasn't a serious matter, if this wasn't a massive black eye for the Democrats, that certainly would have happened. And the whole Democratic Convention right now is sort of under this cloud of scandal as a result of this email leak.
And Thomas, Debbie Wasserman Schultz stepping down as DNC chair is getting a lot of attention. What's not getting much attention is that she is now going to chair Hillary Clinton's 50-state program. In a statement, Hillary Clinton thanked her, quote, longtime friend Debbie for her leadership, saying, quote, there's simply no one better at taking the fight to the Republicans than Debbie. She says the two are going to campaign together across the country to help elect Clinton to the White House and help Debbie Wasserman Schultz's reelection campaign in Florida.
Yeah, nice move, Hillary. I tell you, the way these people play politics, it's so amateurish sometimes. one of the narratives that the Republicans really emphasized at their campaign was the lack of accountability. You know, that a certain class of political players is basically above the law. You know, and Hillary herself furnishes this sort of the example that they love to turn to because she didn't get into any trouble over the email scandal of her own. But if you could extend this, talk about how Wall Street actors were never punished. You know, all of these different people got free passes during the Obama administration. And here's somebody that basically had her finger on the scales, you know, during the primary campaign. And by the way, we'll talk about this in a second, but they're just going to give her a job somewhere else. You know, there's like zero accountability with these people. So, by the way, so last night I started just digging through the WikiLeaks. You know, there's 20,000 emails. It's too many for anybody to read. And there's going to be more coming out soon, they say.
Right.
And I was just entering almost random search terms from the primary campaign, and there is tons more stuff that they say about Bernie. You know, it goes on and on and on. Like, I entered the word Bernie bro. Yes, they referred to him as a Bernie bro. You know, which is this sort of bogus narrative that was made up at some point to describe fans of Bernie Sanders as a sexist hooligan. You know. It's all over the place. Anyhow, yes, this is very embarrassing for the Democratic National Committee.
Yeah, and as you said, Thomas, it's really easy to search this database. You just have to put in a keyword, and we'll put a link to that at yourcallradio.org. Now, there's information also about the inner workings of the party's finance operation. The Washington Post and McClatchy seem to be the only outlets covering this, although, Dave, is Open Secrets in the Center for Responsive Politics going to cover what the emails reveal about how the party basically says, if you give us $33,400, you will have a place across the table from President Obama? That's what these emails reveal.
Can't speak to what Open Secrets will do, but certainly at the Center for Public Integrity here, we're taking a look very closely at these. I would tune back in on publicintegrity.org later today. But yes, some of the emails do reveal how the money game works. None of it that I've read seems terribly surprising, because whether you're a Democrat or Republican, there is massive machinery that is spooled in motion in order to generate cash, for better or for worse. That's the way that the game is played today, particularly in the post-Citizens United world of big money in politics. That, of course, being the case 6 years ago, that opened up really the floodgates in a major way to new sources of revenue for politicians, liberal and conservative. But the emails definitely get into sort of, for lack of a better term, the ugly sausage making of how this all works. It talks in some cases about how partisans are in people in the party machine are having to kowtow to big supporters, some of whom that they personally dislike in every way that you could possibly say it. So there's a certain element of ugliness to all of this that shows that, well, you know, it's not just a bunch of people making their $27 donation to the candidate that they like. In fact, there's a whole variety of you know, kind of bowing and curtsying to people who have incredible amounts of money but can use that money to a great extent for the party apparatus that really needs that money, or for candidates like Hillary Clinton that really, really need that money as well.
Thomas, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, as Dave says, it's not surprising, but it just proves that the average person has absolutely no access. In one exchange, a National Finance Director Jordan Kaplan and Alexander Shapiro argued about who should sit next to Obama. They were talking about a Maryland ophthalmologist and a New York philanthropist, and they said that, well, the philanthropist only gave $100,000, whereas the ophthalmologist gave $332,000, so that guy should get to sit next to Obama.
Yeah. Well, look, this goes way back. Like Dave said, this is a well-known phenomenon going back to at least, I mean, this was very pronounced during the Bush years, and we learned all about this during the Abramoff scandal, but this goes back to the Clinton administration. I mean, this goes way back. But look, you're just getting another taste of the system of legalized bribery that is our campaign finance system in this country. It's ugly, and it should shock us. I worry about the day when the shock wears off and we just think this is normal, this is how it ought to be. I guess the only thing that's really astonishing about it is that there's so many, you know, there's a lot of people who are very idealistic about the Democratic Party and think and believe that the Democrats are somehow above this stuff, and well, they aren't.
Well, and let's talk a little bit about how, let's stick with the Democrats for now, since the emails were leaked, how the funders have really changed over the years. Thomas Frank, you've been covering this for many, many years. What's really changed when we look at who's funding the Democrats?
One of okay, so there's many ways to answer that question, but the part that really intrigues me is certain industries as the contested terrain of American politics, you know, the two parties fighting back and forth to win the funding of particular industries. And in this case, I'm thinking of Wall Street, you know, which was traditionally a Republican constituency for eons, you know, going back to Roosevelt, of course, because of all the terrible things that Roosevelt did to Wall Street. And then beginning in the Clinton years, they started to, you know, the Democrats sort of made their pitch to Wall Street and really developed a whole ideology or a whole sort of political system, theoretical system in which they imagined that Wall Street was on their side, right? Because these are creative executives, they're professionals, they have advanced degrees and that sort of thing. And they came up with this whole theory. And lo and behold, Barack Obama actually outraised John McCain on Wall Street, which was the first time that it ever happened for a Democrat to do that. And then it reversed, of course, with Mitt Romney, who you know, was one of Wall Street's own people, so of course he won their favor. But now it looks like they're going back the other direction because of you know, they don't approve of Donald Trump. Donald Trump has said really mean things about them. And then at the very last minute, I don't know if you saw this the story in the papers right before the Cleveland convention. The Republicans inserted into their platform language to the effect that they would reinstate the Glass-Steagall law. Did you see this? They're going to break up. They claim they're going to break up the Wall Street banks. The Republican Party.
Right.
So, look, now you're going to see a stampede the other direction, back to Hillary Clinton. And in fact, the story that I read in the Washington Post about the Republicans promising to bring back Glass-Steagall, which is hilarious on the face of it. But in this story, they talked to, among other people, the Treasury Secretary during the Bush administration, Hank Paulson, who is actively supporting Hillary Clinton. So this is what's fascinating, the way this one industry, they fight back and forth, and it goes one way one year, and then it goes the other way the other year. You could say the same thing about the Koch brothers. They're very unhappy with Donald Trump.
Right. They're very unhappy with Donald Trump. They are happy with Mike Pence. They have funded Mike Pence's campaigns in the past, and they say that they're going to spend their $900 million on Senate races. Dave Leventhal, what about all the dark money groups? I mean, that's the thing that's hard to track, right? So the Koch brothers publicly say they're not going to support Donald Trump. What do you think? Do you think they're going to get involved in the presidential election this time around?
It's highly unlikely that they will. All indications are that the network of organizations that the Koch brothers help fund, and we're talking about a variety typically of nonprofit organizations that do not have to disclose where they get their money from, but yet have some ability to actively and directly engage in the political process, they're going to be focusing their efforts primarily on U.S. Senate races, perhaps some House races, but are steering clear to an incredible sense during this current election. A year ago, if we were having this conversation, everyone, Republicans, Democrats, liberals, conservatives, would have said, oh, of course the Koch brothers are going to play huge. They're going to be an overriding factor in the presidential election. That is not coming to pass. So the notion that Mike Pence being on the ticket is going to cause the Koch brothers to suddenly jump in for Donald Trump, highly unlikely at this point. It would definitely be a major shift from where the Koch brothers seem headed. So when we talk about dark money, we're talking about a kind of money that just simply can't be traced back to its root source. And on the Republican side, that is going to play certainly a major factor both up and down the ticket at the presidential race level, and also to the congressional race level, maybe to even a stronger degree. But I'd be remiss not to mention, too, that Hillary Clinton's campaign operation has also, to a significant extent, and we're talking in the millions and millions of dollars, has benefited pretty directly from dark money, which is the very kind of stuff that her campaign has been outwardly aggressive against. Hillary Clinton is very much on record saying, if I become president, We will try to pass a constitutional amendment, approve a constitutional amendment to roll back Citizens United. We will try to get big money out of politics. I will be an enemy of big money in politics, but yet at the same time, too, and we wrote a very extensive article about this very issue a couple months back, Hillary Clinton, much more so than Donald Trump, is the beneficiary in 2016 of the rights that Citizens United spooled forward, and Hillary Clinton's network of super PACs that are supporting her, in many cases, have benefited from dark money donations to those super PACs. So nobody here is free and clear when it comes, so to speak, to from dark money, and both candidates to a rather notable extent are benefiting from it.
And Dave, what strikes you about the groups, the corporations, the people who are funding the Democrats? How has that changed over the years? Thomas talks a lot about, you know, Wall Street, and now Silicon Valley is giving the Dems a lot of money.
Yeah, and I think Tom has great points about that. I think you will see what you've seen in the past with Hillary Clinton, that some notable folks on Wall Street, they support Hillary Clinton. They think that she is the right candidate for the United States in the here and now, and have thought that about her campaigns in 2008 and when she was running for the Senate. So I think it's very reasonable to believe that that Wall Street entities are going to help Hillary Clinton in a pretty major way, particularly when Donald Trump, at pretty much every pass here, is saying, we need to roll back trade agreements. We need to kill our trade agreements in Asia and in Latin America. We need to do something completely different, and I want to get rid of all of that. Well, if you're a corporation that has major business overseas in Latin America and Asia, that's going to be disquieting to you. If you're somebody who's a Wall Street financier or whatnot, and you make money off of that type of activity, that also, too, is going to be disconcerting for you. But I would just add one other thing, that when you talk about corporate giving, well, corporations still can't give direct money to candidates. That is still against the law as it is right now. But what corporations can do is they can fund super PACs, and to a stronger degree, they can fund nonprofit organizations that in turn are playing politics with that kind of money, whether it's secret money or not. And we've seen that time and time again with Hillary Clinton operations, that type of activity is occurring. And we've seen a lot of, limited liability companies or limited liability partnerships, even nonprofit groups, which are corporations in their own right, giving money to Hillary Clinton super PACs, and we cannot trace that money back to a root source or to a human source. So it's something that Hillary Clinton in her campaign has grappled with, trying on one hand to present themselves as strong, staunch advocates of campaign finance reform, while at the same time operating in a system that they're advocating against. Their answer is simply, well, we got to operate by the rules as they are today, but we will change them in the future. If you're a Bernie Sanders supporter, that kind of hits you a little flat in your ears when you listen to that kind of message.
Dave Leventhal is senior political reporter for the Center for Public Integrity. They do amazing reporting on money in politics. You can find their articles at publicintegrity.org. Thomas Frank is a journalist, author of the best-selling book, What's the Matter with Kansas? His latest is Listen, Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. And Tom was on about a month or so ago talking about that book. You can search for it at yourcallradio.org. Dave and Thomas are joining us from Philadelphia, where the Democrats are kicking off their convention today. They were both in Cleveland last week attending the Republican convention. So what questions do you have about money and politics? What do you want to know about who's funding Hillary Clinton and the Democrats, who's funding Donald Trump and the Republicans? Very major changes we're seeing because of Donald Trump. And then also, who's funding these conventions? We'll talk with Dave about that later in the show. Thomas, let's spend a little more time talking about the Silicon Valley and what stands out for you, why this matters. Silicon Valley is throwing its support behind Hillary Clinton. Eric Schmidt, Sheryl Sandberg, a Facebook, Airbnb CEO, Brian Chesky, Netflix CEO, Reed Hastings, they've all endorsed Hillary Clinton for president. Also, if you just look at the numbers, Steven Silberman is a computer magnate. He's donated $800,000. You've got Mark Heising of a Medley Partners, an equity firm, donating $500,000. Talk about why this matters, why Silicon Valley supporting the Democrats and Hillary Clinton matters.
Yeah, and by the way, I'd add one more item to your list. So here in Philadelphia, they've got some special deal with Uber. So they have a special app for the Democratic convention or something like this, and everybody's talking about Uber here and how that's how you're going to be getting around the city. And there, that wasn't the case in Cleveland. So the Democrats' alliance with Silicon Valley is fascinating because it wasn't all that long ago. You know, I was writing about Silicon Valley back in the 90s, that we thought of it as a very libertarian place, a place that was sort of naturally aligned with the politics of the Republican Party, you know, the pro-business, pro-market politics of the Republican Party. I remember the sort of leading commentator on Silicon Valley back in those days was George Gilder, who was one of the favorites of Ronald Reagan. He's very close with the Reagan administration, and he wrote all of a series of books about Silicon Valley and how things were done there. And that was really who they were in those days. And since then, they have shifted pretty dramatically, politically speaking, over to the Democratic Party. And this is largely a result of, I think, a change within the Democratic Party that undergirds everything that we're talking about here. You know, when we talk about money in politics, it only takes you so far in understanding why the parties do what they do. There's also a lot of sociological explanations for why the parties are where they are. The Democratic Party, you know, has decided in the last over the course of the last couple of decades that they really don't want to be who they used to be, the party of working people, the party of organized labor, the party of, you know, blue-collar America. That's not who they want to be. They want to be the party of innovation, of these sort of winners in the new economy, and they identify themselves very strongly with Silicon Valley. You look at Barack Obama and the many, many press conferences and events that he did with Mark Zuckerberg. You look at their weird relationship with Eric Schmidt of Google, who, you know, I was writing this book about the Democrats, and this guy, Eric Schmidt, he just keeps popping up in the Democratic story. It's like, here's Hillary Clinton doing a press conference in the Netherlands, and she gives a shout-out to Eric Schmidt, who's right there in the audience. Here's Barack Obama, you know, doing his first press conference after he's elected president in 2008. And there's Eric Schmidt standing just off to the right side of the president. He's all over the place in Democratic gatherings. And this is because of that. I spoke a few minutes ago about the ideology that the Democrats developed in the 1990s to understand themselves as a party of the professional class, as a party of the sort of innovation class and the creative class. And they really do understand Silicon Valley as a core constituency of theirs. It's much more important to them than, say, organized labor or something like that. Although organized labor, of course, also gives a lot of money to the Democrats.
And you mentioned Eric Schmidt. Reuters has a piece out in March saying that the former executive of Google will head a new Pentagon advisory board aimed at bringing Silicon Valley innovation and best practices to the U.S. military. This is the lead of a Reuters story. It sounds kind of like a press release.
Yeah, that's awesome. By the way, there was a very interesting, there's one Silicon Valley figure at the Republican convention. It was Peter Thiel.
Right.
You know, the guy from PayPal. And what he said was actually fascinating. I'm not endorsing his sort of view of the world. Again, a very libertarian guy. But he said, you know, he's talking about innovation, and he said, you know, Silicon Valley is this one very small little area, and we think of this as the headquarters of American innovation, but it wasn't all that long ago that you had innovation all over the country. And he talked about all the stuff that used to happen in Cleveland, you know, back in the, like, early 1960s and stuff like that. It was actually really interesting. In the same speech, by the way, he denounced, this is at the Republican convention, he denounced the culture wars as a kind of distraction meant to draw our attention away from economic decline. How about that, huh? That's a Republican saying that. I couldn't believe my ears.
I also wanted to ask you quickly before we go to break. Recode has a story about Hillary Clinton's tech policy proposals. They say it sounds like a love letter to Silicon Valley. She wants to create a high-level working group consisting of experts, business, and labor leaders to tackle the Uber-style gig economy.
Yeah, I don't know what they mean by that, but one of the things that Democrats have basically completely turned a blind eye to what is happening in the labor market. The gig economy is the term for it. But this is something that's basically disastrous for Democrats' traditional constituency of blue collar workers. And Barack Obama and you look at the various Democratic governors around the country have done virtually nothing about looking at what's going on, trying to figure out ways to deal with what's going on. Maybe they're turning over a new leaf here, but I strongly doubt it. The Democrats have really tried to do everything in their power to identify themselves with the masters of the winners of the gig economy, not the losers, not the people who are driving the Uber cars, but the people who run Uber.
And this is one reason why so many white working class voters, people who cannot make ends meet, are flocking to Donald Trump. And I want to ask about that after the break. Thomas Frank is a journalist, author of the best-selling book, What's the Matter with Kansas? His latest is Listen, Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. Dave Leventhal is senior political reporter with the Center for Public Integrity, a nonprofit news organization, and they closely follow the money. Thomas and Dave are both joining us from Philadelphia, where the Democratic Convention kicks off today, and we are following the money. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW, local public radio. To take part in today's conversation, you may call us at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. And if you prefer to write rather than call, you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org, leave a comment at yourcallradio.org, or you may tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @yourcallradio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will continue our convention coverage by talking about Hillary Clinton's foreign policy. Hillary Clinton supported the invasion of Iraq, the military's involvement in Libya. She also unconditionally supports Israel. So what is Hillary Clinton's foreign policy doctrine? And if she becomes president, how will her views shape U.S. foreign policy? If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are following the money. We're talking about who is funding the Democratic Party and Hillary Clinton, who's funding the Republican Party and Donald Trump. Also, who is funding these conventions? Because a lot of money is being spent at the conventions. Corporations are hosting parties. And so if you have any questions about this, following the money, give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can also tweet at Your Call Radio. And Dave, I wanted to ask you about some of the top contributors to Hillary Clinton. Open Secrets has a great database. You've done a couple stories on some of these large donors. So I want to first ask you quickly to tell us about, at the top of Hillary's list is the Saban Capital Group giving $10 million to Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, and when you talk about numbers that are numbering in the millions of dollars, what we're talking about here is money that are going to pro-Hillary Clinton super PACs, these organizations, these political committees that can raise and spend unlimited amounts of money to advocate for Hillary Clinton or, in many cases, to beat up on Donald Trump. So Haim Saban, who is the leader of that group, he's donated millions upon millions of dollars to the Clinton cause, mainly through a particular super PAC called Priorities USA Action, which is sort of the flagship super PAC run by a lot of close Clinton associates, people who are very close to Hillary Clinton, and was the super PAC supportive of Barack Obama in 2012. It's made the shift over to Hillary Clinton in the past couple of years. But there are people like George Soros, Fred Eichner, folks who may or may not be household names, but are giving millions upon millions of dollars to these groups. There's an organization called Fair Share Action, hardly a household name in and of itself. It's a super PAC that is funded by a nonprofit group that has given millions of dollars to pro-Hillary Clinton super PAC. So the logical question there is, well, all right, ultimately, how do you trace the money all the way back? And you can't. We've talked to this organization. They said, well, we're just going by the law, and we don't have to reveal who our ultimate donors are. So there's sort of that element to what's going on as well. That's not the majority of money coming into pro-Hillary Clinton super PACs, but it's definitely something that numbers into well into the seven figures. So, yeah, you know, there's a very elite number of people, very small number of folks who account for the bulk of the money that's going into the Hillary Clinton super PAC operation. On the campaign side, it's a little bit different, because if you or anyone else in America wanted to give a contribution to the Hillary Clinton campaign, you can only give $2,700, no more, per election. $2,700 in the primary, $2,700 in the general election. You give a penny more, that's going to be too much. So you can sort of see the parallel tracks that the campaign runs on. You've got the campaign operation itself for Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. You get limited contributions going into those, and then you have this other world, the super PACs, that can just take a $10 million check if they want to and start using that money the next day. Very different.
Okay, and so just quickly, the Saban Group, $10 million, the New Yorker wrote a profile about this. Major, major number one issue is Israel. And then number two, you've got, and you've written about this, Dave, the Renaissance Technologies. These are hedge fund guys, and Renaissance Technology gave Hillary, James Simons gave Hillary $9 million, and his big mm-hmm. thing is a tax code that treats hedge funds and their managers. It changes the tax code.
A very quick anecdote. We reported back in April about how Saban had written a letter to Hillary Clinton and basically talking about the very issues that are close to his heart within a matter of, I believe it was 3 days, you know, effectively a donation gets made as a result of a response from Hillary Clinton herself. So is there a quid pro quo there? That's difficult to say. You can make your own conclusions. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that if you're making contributions in the millions of dollars, you get access, you get attention, you get your phone calls returned. You are not going to be ignored, whether you are Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. If somebody is funding your operations or your success as a political candidate to that degree, it's not like you're just going to be persona non grata. On the contrary, you're going to be you're going to be catered to, and that's effectively what many of these big donors want. Sure, there's a philosophical, ideological element to it. Of course there is, but yet of course they don't want to be ignored, and they are almost never ignored.
We have a number of calls. Let's hear from William. Hi, William. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you very much. Maybe there's a bright side in that there are so many new means of communication. You can't turn on your computer without seeing something for Trump or for Hillary Clinton. And there are so many means of communication now that it costs very little to put these ads on, for instance, with your online newspaper. I get them all the time. And then there gets to be a saturation point where they just become background noise. So the question to the guests is whether they feel that because of this low-cost advertising with which we are deluged, financial donations may be less have less effect on the actual election than it would in a time when there were fewer and more expensive, only more expensive means of communication.
Who'd like to comment on that?
Well,
Thomas.
Yeah, there's people have been talking about this for years, that the internet means the death of traditional advertising. And you know, you certainly look in the Republican primaries. You had these very well-funded candidates like Jeb Bush who were relying on traditional advertising, and they got beaten by a guy who barely advertised at all.
Well, he got $2 billion in free media coverage.
Exactly,
right?
So, but free media coverage because he's this celebrity, this outrageous figure. Everybody knows who he is. They're fascinated by him. I mean, there's TV networks that cut away every time, you know, to his speech every time he speaks. people are absolutely fascinated by this guy. And so he was able to ride that instead of spending money on traditional advertising. But, you know, the idea that the structures and power and money don't matter anymore, I think, is it would be really nice if that were the case. You know, the idea of democracy via the internet. But that's just not happening in my way of looking at things. It may be that television becomes less powerful. You know, that is certainly happening. But, you know, the traditional sources of power and authority have by and large managed to make the transition to the internet.
Right. And Dave, go ahead.
I would just quickly add to that money is still, you need a requisite amount to get your foot through the door. Donald Trump, of course, is a singular kind of candidate in a way, a unique candidate in that he commanded this outsized amount of attention versus the amount of money that he was spending on his race. There was a certain cult of personality to that all that we just haven't seen in U.S. presidential politics and in modern history. So Donald Trump aside, think about Bernie Sanders. People like to think of the grassroots swell that Bernie Sanders rode in order to have the kind of success that he was ultimately able to have, going from an independent known socialist in Congress where nobody thought that he had a chance in Hades of competing with Hillary Clinton, to giving her about as good a run for her money as possible. Bernie Sanders raised an incredible amount of money, and he also spent an incredible amount of money outspending Hillary Clinton in certain months during the primary, and much of that was going to tens and tens of thousands of television ads that were being aired in key primary states and whatnot, in addition to all the different types of things that he was doing to run his campaign. You still need money to fuel your campaign operation, and this is sort of the question for Donald Trump right now. Is he going to have enough money? He may be a billionaire, but he's not a billionaire who's spending hundreds of millions of dollars on his own campaign yet. So Hillary Clinton has a lot more money than Donald Trump has right now, and when you're running a nationwide campaign where you need people getting folks off their couch and to the ballot booth, that takes effort, that takes money, that takes people, that takes an operation. And right now Hillary Clinton is winning by that measure over Donald Trump's operation.
Well, thank you for calling in, William. Let's go next to Nancy in Berkeley. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I just heard about this big snafu this morning, and I have a couple questions and a comment about this. I'm wondering how this is going to affect Bernie supporters, not only at the convention but at the ballot box, because they're not. We're not greatly in favor of Hillary as it is. I'm going to vote for her as I hold my nose because I'm so worried about Trump. But, I'm not a young person, and I'm just wondering. And the other thing I was going to say was, I always thought Hillary was a fairly smart politician, but I think her picking of Tim Kaine was disastrous if she wants more liberal people to support her. She had the great opportunity to nominate either Julio Castro or Cory Booker as vice president, and she really screwed it up.
Well, a lot of people are saying that. So you brought up a couple things. Today at a breakfast of Florida delegates in Philadelphia at the convention, Debbie Wasserman Schultz was heckled. Opponents shouted shame, shame, shame. And a lot of people are saying this is going to happen throughout the week. And then we have a couple related emails, completely opposite. Catherine says, please stop talking about the DNC and Hillary as if they're one and the same. This is misleading and incendiary. These emails do not reflect badly on Hillary Clinton. They reflect badly on the DNC. And then Rob says, how closely was the Clinton campaign involved with the DNC's efforts to stifle Sanders' campaign? What did Clinton know, and when did she know it? That's a good question, Dave. Do we have those answers yet?
No, All very good questions,
yeah.
And we don't quite have the answers yet, although, you know, when the Democratic National Committee is coming out and effectively trying to tamp down enthusiasm for Bernie Sanders, that of course is going to rile Bernie Sanders people up in a way this week that the Democrats wanted absolutely nothing of. This was supposed to be a convention about unity. This was supposed to be a convention about Bernie folks and Hillary Clinton folks all getting together behind the Clinton candidacy so that they could go into November beating up not on each other but on Donald Trump. Well, that's kind of a dream and a hope and a wish right now. And you mentioned one event that was happening. Bernie Sanders was speaking while we're talking on the radio right now, and he was effectively getting booed by his own supporters when he said that Hillary Clinton is somebody that we need to go out and support. There are plenty of Bernie folks out there who are incredibly upset. They are apoplectic about what has happened. So as a result, you know, the enthusiasm going into the convention for Hillary Clinton right now, regardless of what she did or didn't do, it is probably going to have a big old wet blanket thrown on it by virtue of these emails. But I would just add one other thing that you have sort of in the offing, Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate, who nobody's really talking about a whole lot, but at the same time, too, is making as strong a case as she can right now that, look, if you liked Bernie Sanders, there's an alternative out there. There's me. Mm-hmm. And she's polling 1 or 2%. She really, in any realistic way, is not going to win the presidency of the United States. At the same time, though, she can make a lot of noise, and you better believe that she is going to use this to her advantage as much as possible to try to bleed away some Bernie Sanders supporters, and that could spell trouble for Hillary Clinton if in a very, very close race in a key state like Ohio or Florida, Jill Stein is getting a couple percentage points. Those are percentage points that are probably not going to come from Donald Trump. Those are probably going to come from Hillary Clinton, although the same could be said on the Republican side with Gary Johnson, the Libertarian candidate, making the same case in a way against Donald Trump.
Right, and I think he's pulling at about 9%, and we're in the process of inviting Jill Stein and Gary Johnson to come on the show. Thomas Frank, what are your thoughts on this? Yesterday, 3,000 Bernie supporters took to the streets of Philadelphia in 100-degree heat. The Philadelphia Inquirer interviewed a bunch of them, and so many said they're leaving the Democratic Party and they're registering green.
Yeah, and there were a lot of them that weren't Democrats in the first place. So I was just downtown to pick up my credentials, and in downtown Philadelphia, and I saw Bernie supporters protesting just in the few minutes I was walking through downtown. This will absolutely infuriate them. I think with good reason. It is infuriating stuff. And by the way, it's not just Jill Stein that is trying to reach out to Bernie supporters. It's of course Trump. Trump talks about Bernie fighting a rigged system twice, not once but twice, in his acceptance speech at the Republican convention. This is part of his strategy, is to win these voters over, and this is going to help.
I want to get back to money. When you look at Open Secrets, I mean, Hillary Clinton has so many more zeros on her contributors than Donald Trump. Trump's list, John Powers Middleton Companies, $150,000, that's at the top of his list. And again, these are super PACs. Hillary Clinton's top, again, is Saban Capital Group at $10 million. So $10 million versus $150,000. There's some construction companies on Trump's list. I mean, these are small donations. Bank of America, $11,000. Dave Leventhal, major, major differences here.
Huge difference. And we heard Donald Trump time and time again during the entire balance of the primary fight when he was running against other Republicans. What did he say? He said, I'm a billionaire. I'm not beholden to anyone. I don't need anyone else's money. Super PACs, they're scams. On and on again, you heard everything from Donald Trump that would indicate that he didn't want anyone else's money except his own money. And for a while, that was the case. He largely self-funded his own campaign and would get some donations here and there from supporters who really believed in his candidacy and his cause, and they made contributions and he accepted them. But come May of this year, when it was clear that Donald Trump was going to be the nominee of the Republican Party. He had vanquished Ted Cruz and John Kasich in their final throes of the anyone but Trump effort that they were staging. He changed. He went 180 degrees in the opposite direction and began embracing all of the things that he had criticized during the primary. So what's Donald Trump doing now? Well, Donald Trump embracing super PACs. Donald Trump taking money from whomever is going to give it to him. Donald Trump attending fundraisers. He is setting up a huge financial operation because he just has so much to catch up with. Hillary Clinton is indeed way out ahead of him right now. And we get the question all the time, well, if Donald Trump is so filthy rich, why isn't he just writing $100 million checks for himself to his own campaign? And the reality, it may be twofold. Number one, he may not want to yet. And number two, it's logistically very difficult for him to liquidate his assets, which oftentimes are not just sitting in a bank account in cash, which he can use tomorrow, but are going to be tied up in real estate and hotels and all the different business interests and corporations that he owns all across the world. You can't just snap your finger if you're Donald Trump and say, okay, well, I'm instantly liquidating this into money that my campaign can spend. That's just not feasible for him at this point, and he's just simply running out of time to do that. If he wanted to do that a year ago, well, maybe that would have been possible. But at this juncture here in late July, with the election zooming in, coming in November of this year, that's just something that he may not have the option to do.
So what are we expecting at a time when people like Paul Ryan and others are coming around to endorsing Donald Trump? Do you think they're going to talk to their elite donors and say, all right, you might not like this guy, but you have no choice?
Already happening, and you have some Republicans who are very dubious about Donald Trump, but are going to get behind him because they consider Hillary Clinton to be a much greater evil for this country, in their opinion. So as a result, are getting behind Donald Trump. But the question is, to what degree is this going to be effective? Already, the Koch brothers are on the sidelines. Already, you have some other big-time Republican donors who are just simply not going to get in the game, either in the way that they have in the past or at all. So this is troubling for Donald Trump from a financial standpoint, and it just doesn't seem to be getting a whole lot better. The last round of campaign finance numbers that we got in the middle of last week didn't give any indication that Donald Trump was in a healthier state financially than he was the month before. Hillary Clinton was still outraising him and is doing so just campaign to campaign alone, about 3-1 when you throw in all the super PACs. She's way out ahead of him, even more than that.
Thomas Frank, what do you think about this? And what do you think about the idea that Trump maybe doesn't need to raise that much money because he's still getting so much media coverage? I mean, when I get my email daily list from the New York Times, the Washington Post, Trump is in 90% of the articles. He's still dominating.
Yeah, and if you look at if you go on, the Washington Post website and read their list of the most read, most emailed stories, it's always like the top five are always about Trump, whatever they've written about Trump today. People are obsessed with this guy, fascinated by this guy in all sorts of different ways, both healthy and unhealthy. The thing that fascinates me is the reversal of it all, that this is the Republican candidate is being, lapped many times by the Democrat. Now, she is a Clinton and she knows how to play the game. She's very good at it. But still, we are witnessing, in all sorts of different ways, a sort of inversion of the party roles in all sorts of different ways. Also Trump's appeal to blue collar voters, all of these different things that are going on. It's we're living in really crazy times.
Yeah, and also, Dave, you had an interesting article about, well, it's no surprise that a lot of very wealthy people give to both parties, but this piece is Donald Trump's new finance guru, Stephen Mnuchin, was once a Clinton donor and a George Soros employee.
He was, and Donald Trump himself is a former Clinton donor. So, Steve Mnuchin is an interesting character in the sense that he has very much been even in his contributions to Democrats and Republicans. But George Soros is often held up as sort of the boogeyman by conservatives as the liberal boogeyman. And here, Donald Trump's number one money man is somebody who used to work for George Soros, and wasn't just a rank-and-file employee, but a top employee of Soros's private operation. So, you know, there's sort of these just bizarre intricacies and oddities of this campaign where Donald Trump attended, or Hillary Clinton attended Donald Trump's wedding, and Donald Trump used to give money to Hillary Clinton's political operation, and the two of them, although they like to hate on each other as much as they humanly can right now, are still inextricably linked by their histories. And Steve Mnuchin, the finance guru, is just sort of the latest character in this very, very odd drama that continues to play out in the most unexpected of ways.
Well, right. And then more strange bedfellows. You report that the Dems have raised about $6 million for their convention. Republicans have raised $19 million. On the Dem side, you've got, and the same, these companies are giving money to the Democrats for their convention, Walmart and Honeywell, along with the American Federation of Teachers Labor Union.
Yeah, and the convention funding is a whole issue unto itself. Both sides have struggled a little bit. The Republicans were certainly struggling. The Democrats have also had their share of issues. Both conventions will go on, and you know, they're not going to stop by lack of funds. But you know, it does speak to that certain corporations just really don't want to associate themselves, particularly with the Trump side. And there are some corporations too that. You know, are going to be favoring Hillary Clinton or getting involved in the Philadelphia convention, but may not be quite as excited about it as they were when Barack Obama was the presidential nominee in 2008 and 2012.
And Thomas Frank, in our final minute, talk again about what this says, what this does to the so-called democracy in the U.S. We're going to talk about this on Thursday, specifically this Princeton study that came out and looked at how the overwhelming majority of the population support a minimum wage increase, for example, support better health care, better education, and yet politicians are on the exact other side, and it's because of money in politics.
It's because of money in politics, but it's also because of who the two political parties identify with. So to give you the sort of broad, you know, sociological contours, you know, money is obviously a big part of the question here. You know, money defines what's going on. Money makes it all possible. But you've got more than one money group in America. And the way I look at it, there's two higher. Well, look, Donald Trump has thrown everything up into the air. We don't really know what's going on anymore with the Republican Party. But the Republican Party minus Trump answers to the hierarchy of business, generally speaking. You know, big business. That's who they are. They're the hierarchy of money, and the Democrats answer to this the hierarchy of status, of prestige, advanced degrees. That's how they understand themselves. That's how the two parties understand themselves, or understood themselves until the rise of Donald Trump, which, as I said, it just puts everything up in the air, and who knows where it's all going to land.
Well, we will definitely continue following money and politics. Thomas Frank is author of the new book, Listen, Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People, and Dave Leventhal is senior political reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. Thank you both for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Your call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.